diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hi, everybody. Kate Delaney, America Tonight. Very thrilled to be broadcasting from the United Nations Radio Day. We've talked to some fascinating people, and we're excited about our next guest because it seems like he's been anywhere and everywhere. That's like my fantasy. Patrick McCormick joins us now. He's been working for UNICEF. And let me just tell you what he's doing, because we want to get specific here. He's covering emergencies since 94. So the very first emergency, the tragedy in Rwanda. He's also been to Somalia, the Balkans, Sierra Leone, and the list of countries goes on and on. And recently he's been to Haiti. Patrick, welcome to ATN.
Thank you very much. One country you didn't mention is DPRK, which is... Not many people have been there.
No kidding. Actually, since you brought that up first, let's start there. What can you tell us about DPRK?
Well, I was there some time ago now. It was one of my first missions, and it was even more secretive then than it is now. That's kind of hard to believe. And it was just at the beginning of the problems they've been having now, reoccurring every year, of severe food shortages. And I went out into the countryside and saw children who were, you know, were severely malnourished. And as we know, this is something which, for various reasons, is happening now on a yearly basis.
So when you see something like that, I'm sure it just breaks your heart. But you've traveled to some of these amazing places, but that have had terrible tragedies. What do you do when you're working on these emergencies? What you're certainly the eyes, and you're seeing things. What do you try to do besides raise awareness?
Well, raising awareness is the main reason I'm there, that's for sure. But you get caught up into all sorts of things. I mean, I've given out water, food. I've picked up children abandoned on the sides of roads in Africa, taking them somewhere. I mean, you pitch in. I mean, that's what it's all about. And whatever it takes, whatever you have to do, even if what you're looking at is so enormous, and I never forget once... standing on top of a hill and looking across at the refugee camps of Hutus who had fled Rwanda onto the other side, and it was as far as the eye could see of people, camps, smoke fires, and I just looked at it and thought, my goodness, you know, how is that going to ever be resolved? And the situation in that part of the world is still unresolved, as a matter of fact. It is heartbreaking often. But, I mean, I wouldn't swap this job for anything in the world.
Yeah. You mentioned the Rwanda thing. Was that had to be frustrating, what you just described, because you're trying to, I'm sure, rattle cages in a sense to say, listen, do you understand what's going on here? And that had to be an awful thing to see how that was resolved. Thank goodness, at least... Rwanda has moved forward somewhat, but I think some people had no idea how bad it was. And you're a former journalist, so you probably, I'm sure, were trying to get people to raise the awareness on this. Was that tough for you?
I mean, Rwanda was fascinating and terrible in equal measures. It was probably the first really kind of televised emergency. I mean, everybody was there. I remember, you know... I didn't have to go and find media to tell them what we were doing. They came to us.
Right.
And it was in a country which I bet you most people had never heard of before.
Sure.
Even knew where it was. Tiny little place. Nothing much had happened there. Suddenly an explosion of the most ferocious magnitude in a matter of months, 600,000, 700,000 people killed. Such a small country, they all know each other. I mean, the whole thing was horrendous. Now, Rwanda, as you say, has moved forward incredibly well, but the problems still exist on the borders in Congo, which seems to be a never-ending fight between various rebel groups, between remnants from that conflict, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So from a tiny country, which has moved forward... to one of the biggest in Africa, Congo, DRC Congo, which has got the most tremendous problems.
And I mentioned, I mean, there's so many fascinating things we could talk with you about, so we're very pleased to be sitting here with Patrick McCormick, who has, like I said, really seen the world. Haiti and what's happened in Haiti. There are several people that I know that have gone there that say, whoa, you know, so many different tragedies bubble up in so many emergencies that we can't forget about what's going on in Haiti. Where do you think we are with Haiti?
Well, first of all, I have to correct you. I didn't actually go down there. I was just about to go with our executive director, and the mission got cancelled because there were riots, etc., etc. However, I mean, I know through eyes of my colleagues who were there that a country which before the earthquake,
right,
buildings fell down just because they were so badly constructed. They went through two typhoons or cyclones, I don't remember, hurricane storms in a row. It's desperately poor. You know, before the quake, half of the people didn't, you know, half of children didn't have access to school, to water. Ironically, a lot of people are probably better off now in those sort of terms than they were before the quake. Just because the amount, the huge amount of aid and assistance that's gone in there. I mean,
right,
the outpouring of money, of human resources, and it has dwarfed anything we've seen since the tsunami.
Right, right.
I mean, much more, though, for example, than the flooding in Pakistan.
Right.
It ticked every box of an emergency. And so, you know, the only way I can look at it with some sort of measure of hope is this is the chance. They're not going to get another one. They can't blow it. We can't blow it to rebuild a country which is halfway decent for the children, especially, because it's never been anything but a disaster.
Right.
So now they've got the money, they've got the people. Let's do it.
Yeah. Well said. In your role with UNICEF and emergencies, how do you you must have a list, because there's so many things happening. We've just really kicked it around in a couple of different places. That's only scratching the surface. Do you figure out, okay, this is, we got to really beef it up here, then we got to go to number two, we got to go to number three. How do they prioritize that? How do you prioritize the emergencies?
Well, we kind of characterize them by, you know, this sudden onset. That's the earthquake.
Right.
That happens in heartbeat.
Right.
And if it's big, it's big.
Right.
They're the long-standing emergencies, like DRC Congo, like Somalia, like Chad, like Central African Republic, which just go on and on and on. I mean, we're even seeing, you know, recently Libya, for example, is beginning to look like a protracted emergency. There's no quick, like, okay, we're over now, we can get on with the peace building or whatever situation. It's still kind of a stalemate. And those things can just drag on and on and on and on because neither side have got exactly the right amount of muscle to beat the others. And so we're still standing on the sidelines a little bit.
Sure.
Getting attention for the sudden onset emergencies is, and money and the funding and all the expertise we need to fix that is relatively easy. For the ones that just have been going on and on and on and on, it's much more difficult. People, you know, donor fatigue sets in. Well, they never can get it right. It's too difficult. Where's the progress? And in a sense, you have to think, yeah, you know, but we're there and we're doing what we can.
Well said. Patrick McCormick, what a great way to end this interview. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Have you ever heard of a pharmacist who discourages the use of most prescription drugs? Well, pharmacist Ben Fuchs is that person, and boy, is he fascinating. He's a nutritional pharmacist and skincare specialist who operates out of Boulder, Colorado, and to hear this man speak is nothing less than inspiring because he's charismatic and makes a lot of sense. He asks, why take dangerous drugs when all your body needs to stay healthy is all natural with no side effects? Pharmacist Ben sees the human body as a healing and regenerating system, divinely designed to heal and renew itself on a moment-to-moment basis. But it needs nutrition and nutritional supplementation. Ben says you've got to be on a nutritional supplement program if you want to be healthy in 21st century America, and he wants to help people get off the toxic drug treadmill and get on a good nutritional supplement program. I support what pharmacist Ben is saying and doing to help America get healthier, and I urge you to watch and listen to Ben deliver his powerful message at your convenience. Just go to AmericaTonightTeam.com. That's AmericaTonightTeam.com.
On the average, Americans work between 45 to 50 years, hoping to build up enough wealth to retire and live out their golden years. Unfortunately, with taxation, the rising cost of food, energy, housing, and medical, many retirees are forced to live below the poverty line. Is this a flaw of free enterprise, or is our monetary unit we call the Federal Reserve Note forcing us into perpetual debt, ensuring inflation and higher taxes? These questions and more can be answered by reading G. Edward Griffin's book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. Congressman Ron Paul states, it's what every American needs to know about central bank power. A gripping adventure into the secret world of international banking cartel. Hi, this is Ted Anderson. I will give a silver dollar from the early 1900s to anyone who purchases this book. Call 1-800-686-2237 and order a copy today. It's critical that the public be made aware of the system. Call and order your copy today at 1-800-686-2237. That's 1-800-686-2237.
Ready to save? Then you're ready for the Super Summer Sale at Herbal Healer Academy. Herbal Healer has been the leader in quality natural supplements for 23 years. Log on to HerbalHealer.com and take advantage of Herbal Healer Academy's incredible savings on 500 parts per million colloidal silver. The best pharmaceutical grade available and all sizes on sale. Super Male Plex with you Hindi and Super Fem Plex for summer toning. Buy glucosamine chondroitin 60 caps summer sale priced at only $12. Colon Enhancer 250 caps summer sale priced at just $18. And if your brain's a little foggy, we have a great supplement on sale called Memory Power. Log on and hit the postcard specials link for more super summer savings at HerbalHealer.com. As always, new customers get a free catalog with first order. Herbal Healer Academy, healing the world with nature one person at a time.
Yes, indeed. Welcome to America Tonight. I am pleased as punch to be broadcasting from the UN, actually just a stone's throw away from the, I call it the mothership. I'm in the UNICEF area, very important area, of course, of the UN. And I'm sitting here with a very important man. His name is Dan Shepherd, and he's with the Sustainable Development, ready for this, Focal Point Information Officer, Strategic Communications Division. There's got to be some crazy acronym for that. I mean, it's an obvious one, but we got to come up with one for Dan. Dan, welcome to the show, and thanks for stopping by.
Well, thank you for having me.
Let's jump right into this. Talking about sustainable development, this is a huge area in a lot of different countries, certainly. We think of third world countries, but what about big countries like India and China with the kinds of population that you're talking about? Do you work with those countries as well?
Yes, absolutely. Actually, sustainable development's for all countries, rich, poor, big, little. It's about how countries move forward. How do you create prosperity, economic prosperity? How do you improve people's quality of life? How do you do it while protecting the environment? And you can do all three at the same time. And the problems that each country faces are different. The circumstances are different. But basically, the ingredients are the same. And there's some countries, big countries like India, China, they have, you know, huge populations, well over a billion. And they have to contend with finding jobs for people and moving people out of poverty. Improving their lives and doing it without wrecking their environment.
Yeah.
And that's a huge task.
Yeah, and when you say it's a huge task, I mean, obviously, as you're trying to move mountains, what is it that you need? What is it you seek when you're talking about going in and figuring out strategically what people need?
Well, I mean, everybody needs some basic stuff. Water, energy, food, shelters, livable cities. These are sort of the building blocks and jobs. Every country has to figure out how they can do this all at the same time. And to do this, you have to mobilize government, government policies. You have to mobilize your private sector. You have to mobilize your civil society people, education, health. There's a broad array, and it all feeds into the same goal, and that's, you know, moving countries and peoples forward.
So when you, with this kind of a goal, is there some kind of a map? Is there a roadmap that you try to go by? Like, okay, here's our focal point now for this month, for this 6 months, for whatever. Or no, you kind of just have those tentacles out there and you're trying to grab as much as possible.
Well, that's an interesting question. There is sort of a guide to all of this. And all countries have agreed to it. 20 years ago, at the Earth Summit, countries agreed to something called Agenda 21, and that spells out what all the sustainable development is, what are the steps countries need to do. And right now, we're at a time when countries are actually looking what has worked and what hasn't, and for what hasn't, why hasn't it worked. And next year, the world is going to have this 20-year follow-up, also in Rio de Janeiro, called Rio Plus 20, where they're going to look at how do you take this whole agenda forward. And the challenges were all known 20 years ago, but now they're being felt, like in ways never felt before. When people talked about climate change then, it was sort of out there in the future. Now the impacts are being felt. The science is more certain. They talked about the need to conserve biodiversity and natural ecosystems then. But now we're losing species at an unprecedented rate. We're finding that our natural capital, the things nature gives us for free, like water, wood, things from the forest, and food, they're all compromised now. And if we're going to feed, if we're going to feed the world's population, we're going to hit 7 billion people at the end of October. And that's not the end of it. The population is still going to rise after that. We need to take note of all of this and figure out solutions on what we do.
Yeah, how concerned are you that people don't realize it? We talk about that on America Tonight, and we've had other guests that talk about, well, you might have to start thinking about survival things. And when I say survival things, just even things about here in the United States, being able to grow things, being able to do what you have to do, maybe into the future, if more people aren't paying attention to what you just said. So the red flags are there. Do you think people are paying attention to that?
Well, increasingly, yes. In various countries, governments are moving, some faster than others. There still needs to be a lot more awareness around the world. I still think a lot of people think some of these things are just random natural events and chalk it up to acts of, you know, nature, things like that, when in fact they are what is being predicted. Like, for instance, the climate change scientists, they can't say that any weather event is attributed to climate change itself. You don't know that a hurricane is climate change, but you have patterns. When you have more droughts or more intense precipitation, bigger storms and things like that, that is consistent with what they've been saying. And we're seeing the pattern, you know, fit more and more. So a lot of people still haven't gotten it. But I think more and more you see countries, you see businesses moving into markets for green things.
Mm-hmm.
For green solutions, and they're not just doing it because they, you know, think it's nice. They think there's money there. They think that there's markets, and they think that's the future.
So besides this, talking about green solutions, what are some of with the food especially? What do you think has to happen with food?
Well, a number of things. First of all, land around the world. You have to pay attention to how land is used. Is it being used in the right way for the right purpose? Are the right crops being grown in the right spots? Do people have ownership rights of land? Do they have incentive to take care of the land? Farmland is one of poses a lot of environmental hazards in terms of nutrient runoff from farms in the Mississippi Delta. You have all these dead zones in the oceans and the Gulf, and that's all valuable. That's all valuable fertilizer that we're losing, and we're killing our waters. So, I mean, we're doing damage on a number of fronts that could limit our food supply, when in fact, if we think about it and do things differently, we can have our seafood, we could have our land-based agricultural crops, we could expand. The world could probably feed more people. But another big problem is getting the food to the people who need it. Distribution accounts for bad distribution accounts for most of the people who are suffering from a lack of nutrition and things like that. Other issues are really, you know, up for grabs in terms of the debate, genetically modified food and things like that. There's a lot of disagreement on that here at the UN. We haven't come to any
decisions on what you think should happen.
I think people still believe that, you know, using traditional agricultural methods, we can feed the world. But it has to be done rationally, it has to be done sensibly, and using the best agricultural methods.
Yeah, we've got a minute or so left, a minute and a half or so left. Doing the job that you do, what's the most rewarding thing for you about your work with the UN, at the UN?
Well, the most rewarding thing is when you work on something that you feel has moved the needle somewhat forward. I mean, these are difficult issues. They're big issues. They need a lot. But I mean, even when you don't get like a binding treaty on climate change, you feel that all the work done on climate change has really energized the discussion. It has raised the discussion to levels that have not been seen before. And that's really important, because that's how change is going to come, when people know what the problem is, know what the possible solutions are, and can choose for what they think is best.
Yeah. How big is this conference in Rio? Rio plus 20.
Yes. It's going to be big. I mean, it will be, there are all sorts of estimates, 20 to 30,000 people.
Dan Shepherd, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Are you still a traditional smoker? Now experience a new lifestyle and try vaping with e-cigarettes by LeSig. Imagine no ashes, stains, nasty smell, or coughing and hacking. With LeSig e-cigarettes' revolutionary microelectronic technology, rechargeable battery, and unique replaceable cartridge, you'll get all the benefits and satisfaction of smoking without the hazards. Choose your taste from a wide variety of our new American-made Vaporeon e-liquids at LeSig.com. And LeSig smokes the competition by serving thousands of worldwide customers with real people customer service, fast, free, same-day shipping, and a 30-day warranty and satisfaction guarantee. So are you ready for a new vaping lifestyle? Then call 870-518-4307. That's 870-518-4307. Or visit LeSig.com, spelled LeCIG.com. LeSig e-cigarettes for today's modern smoker.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio?
Something more important.
Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Iodine protection packs from hempusa.org are now in stock for immediate delivery worldwide. Our iodine protection packs include micro plant powder, green life kelp, red palm oil, and our clear roll-on iodine that will feed the body the iodine it needs. All iodine protection packs are in stock. Save you money and ship for free in all 50 states. Visit hempusa.org or call 908-691-2608 today.
HempUSA.org has a revolutionary wonder food for detoxing the body and rebuilding the immune system.
Microplant powder can help unclog arteries and soften heart valves while removing heavy metals, virus, fungus, bacteria, and parasites. Plus, it cleans and purifies the blood, lungs, stomach, and colon. Keep your body clean with microplant powder. Visit us at HempUSA.org or call 908-691-2608 today.
If you suffer from poor sleep, you need MyPillow. Guaranteed to be the most comfortable pillow you will ever own. Using a patented fill, MyPillow adjusts to your exact individual needs by gently supporting your head, shoulders, and neck. MyPillow has a natural built-in cooling effect, keeping your cervical nerves cool, giving you the best sleep of your life. MyPillow will never go flat and relieves snoring, migraines, sleep apnea, fibromyalgia, and many other disorders. It's antimicrobial, non-allergenic, dust mite resistant, and best of all, machine washable and dryable. MyPillow is made in the USA, has an A rating with the Better Business Bureau, comes with a 60-day money-back guarantee and an industry-leading 10-year warranty. Order today at MyPillow.com or call 952-442-6199. That's 952-442-6199. Mention coupon code GCN and receive 20% off your order. What do you have to lose except poor sleep? MyPillow.com, the most comfortable pillow you will ever own, guaranteed.
You've heard Alex Jones talk about eFoods Direct and their highly nutritious long-term storable food. Believe me, it tastes great. Order any three of their qualified packs and you'll receive the fourth absolutely free. Let's say you order three of their one-week responder kits. You'll get the fourth week free. That's a $75 savings on a one-month supply. Are you kidding me? For the cost of one greasy fast food supersized combo lunch, you can eat three hearty, delicious meals. And this offer is good for any of their quick fix supplies. This offer ends on June 22nd. eFoods Direct is prepared for these troubled times and will ship your order within 48 hours. Call 800-409-5633. On the web, eFoodsDirect.com/Alex. Your order deadline is June 22nd. To buy three and get one free, call 800-409-5633. On the web, eFoodsDirect.com/Alex. Get more food for your money at eFoodsDirect.com/Alex.
It's always great to be back in New York, and of course, what a big day here at the UN and broadcasting from the UNICEF facility. And we've been introduced to some very interesting people here and talked about a slew of issues facing the United States and the world. This is a big one for us. I want to introduce you to Jeffrey Shaw. Jeffrey Shaw works with an agency that some of you will recognize that we've talked about before, the IAEA. Am I right?
It's a very punchy title, isn't it?
It is. And what's interesting is I think some of you probably recognize what that stands for. We're talking about atomic...
International Atomic Energy Agency.
Energy, yeah. We're talking about inspections, all kinds of things related to that. And I guess, Jeff, first of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
And my first question is, having talked to some people about Fukushima, we've focused a lot as to the people and what happened there, what's happening now, what's going on with the reactors. Tell us the latest from your point of view of what you know of what's going on at Fukushima.
Yeah, they're still working very hard on stabilizing reactors. It's still a very serious problem. They're still monitoring the environment and foodstuffs and the marine environment, for example, and we're working very closely with the Japanese government to do that. But what we're looking towards is we have the immediate emergency we're working on, but we're looking ahead to how we're going to learn from this experience, what lessons need to be learned. And what my director general, our organization is based in Vienna,
mm-hmm.
and we're hosting a meeting, a ministerial level meeting in 2 weeks' time in Vienna to look at exactly this issue, to start a process of looking how countries are prepared to deal with emergencies and how we can review the safety framework with a view to strengthening it. So it'll be an ongoing process. We just had a team come back from Japan. We put together an international team of experts to go into Japan. They've put a preliminary report, and they'll be reporting to this high-level meeting coming up, as I say, in 2 weeks in Vienna.
In what you've seen, and, I mean, obviously, you're right, you're there in the capacity of advisement, I assume, right, and pulling things together, coordinating?
Yeah, we coordinate the international response.
Mm-hmm.
So we bring together all the UN organizations. We work closely, say, with the World Health Organization, the Food and Agriculture Organization, the World Meteorological Organization, provide direct assistance to Japan upon their requests. We also try to validate information that Japan gives to us. And so we're on the ground. We've sent missions, as I say, to monitor food, radiation. We've sent teams in to look at the reactor itself. So, but it's very much in partnership with Japan, clearly.
In looking at what's happened there and talking about reviewing responses and whatnot, how big is the concern? Because what happened at Fukushima, the plant and the location of where it is, and talking to several scientists, they said, well, you know, this location, obviously, they want the water and they're using the water, but it's dangerous because knowing of the possibility of tsunamis and earthquakes. Mm. Would that be one of the things that you'll look at in your review and tell, hey, listen, you've got to be concerned about what could possibly happen here with a natural disaster?
We've been working on this issue. It's not a new issue.
Right.
We've been working with
member
states for some time on this issue. I mean, to put it in perspective, the reactor behaved as it should have. After the enormous earthquake, it shut down. But what the problem was is that their defenses against the tsunami, they catered for a 5.7-meter tsunami, and they were overwhelmed for 14 meters of tsunami.
Oh.
So some of the immediate lessons they'll be learning is, well, how, you know, building better defenses against that situation, making sure that some of our infrastructure is not on the site, maybe at a higher level, so that, you know, the backup generators, which were flooded, and that's what caused the problems,
mm-hmm.
and the meltdown, they're located higher. So this is something that the experts are getting together, and I don't profess to be an expert, but are getting together and looking at these sort of things. So some practical, immediate, but also longer-term ways of strengthening the safety.
When you talk about putting together people that would be advising in long-term, obviously you have to get the countries to agree to want to be participants in that, which I imagine most are, for the most part. We know the ones that wouldn't be. But the looking at the long-term effects, who do you send? Are we talking scientists? Are we talking inspectors? What would a team be that would come in?
It's peer review. We do a lot of peer reviews. I mean, it would take a treaty if we're looking at some sort of inspector,
yeah.
Because you don't have that legal authority. The agency doesn't. What we do is develop standards and provide expert missions to advise governments on how to develop a safety culture, a safety infrastructure. We send teams in to look at operational aspects or regulatory aspects. But that's bringing together the member states, and that has to be a collaborative effort. And I think all member states who operate reactors are saying, yes, we've looked at our own reactors, let's get together and move ahead and look at how lessons we can learn from this and move ahead.
So there's a definite willingness.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
So as I say, we've got the meeting in Vienna. The Secretary General of the United Nations is also having a meeting in September, the 22nd of September, again, to build on that momentum. So we're starting a process, and it will continue forward for a few years.
Yeah. In looking forward and looking ahead and whatnot, how many, I don't even know the answer to this question, I have sort of a ballpark figure, but how many reactors are we talking about? How many different countries?
Currently there are 29 countries, I think, that operate power reactors, not research reactors, but power reactors. I think there's about 440-odd reactors being used to generate electricity around the world. And I can tell you, before this accident in Japan, we had, over the last 12 months, I think 60 or so countries have come to us and said we would like to start nuclear energy programs. Now, clearly, not all countries are ready for that. And our job, we're not in the business of selling reactors. Our job is to provide modeling, And we provide to assistance to states so they can model what's the best mix of energy for them. And it's technology neutral. And it may be that nuclear is not the option, clearly. But the other message we continually give is it's a long-term investment in safety, having a safety culture, having a safety regulatory infrastructure in place, having trained people, not just safety but security and safeguards. All of it, it's a package if it's going to be sustainable.
Right.
And so we continually emphasize this is a long-term investment. It's your sovereign choice. But if you're looking at this as an option, you can't come tomorrow and say, I want to have a nuclear power plant, because it doesn't work that way.
Right.
You have to invest. Invest in all those aspects.
Do you, of some of the nations we're talking about, or some of the places we're talking about, 60, that's significant. Are some of them developing countries,
yeah,
emerging countries?
A lot of countries. Energy security is a critical issue for development.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it underpins all the Millennium Development Goals. Energy.
Sure.
If you don't have energy, you can't develop. So countries are looking at ways to develop energy. And there's a lot of research being done now on small reactors, which may be appropriate for them, where you can come in, you plug in like a nuclear battery, if you will, run it for 10 years and then unplug it and then get it replaced. So clearly a large reactor may not be what's needed, a 1,000-megawatt reactor, but maybe you can have small reactors. And so there's a lot of interest in this area.
Jeff, when you say small reactors, what were you talking about? That's intriguing. I haven't heard that before.
A small reactor would be, you know, under 300 megawatts. So a small, you know, and the technology is not new. I mean, small reactors are used in submarines, for example.
Sure, sure, sure.
So it's this nuclear battery concept. And sometimes we're talking, you know, under 100 megawatts of electricity. But sufficient to power a small, you know, small city, for example, in a developing country which may not have all that infrastructure. And today we don't want to have the hassle of it. Or the need for a large reactor.
What do you think the biggest misconception is about nuclear power? Because there's a lot.
Well, I think there are a lot of misconceptions.
Yeah.
I think I could answer that from my perspective.
Sure, sure.
Working at the agency, the misconceptions is about what our role is.
Right.
A lot of people think we're either A, just selling nuclear power plants, or B, we're just the watchdog. And what we need to think about is that most countries in the world use nuclear technology. Not nuclear power plants, but nuclear technology, either to fight cancer, for example, or to increase crop productions. Or one of the interesting projects we're working on is with water. You know, drought's a big problem. We've got a project in Africa at the moment, 19 countries working together, helping them manage their water resources using nuclear techniques. You can sink wells in the ground, but how long is that aquifer going to last?
Mm.
What's the size of it? Is it being replenished? Is it sustainable? And that's where we work. Most of our member states, that's what they're interested in. And we're holding a big event on that in September in our general conference, bringing together the world's experts on water to look about how we can make a contribution to help in development.
And how it's sustainable.
How it's sustainable, of course.
Mm-hmm.
You can dig wells, but then what happens when it runs out?
Right. And so then it's also teaching the people, if that all goes forward and you put all the, you know, the conversations continue, and as you say, certainly they decide whether a certain country decides whether they're doing it or not. Once they jump on board, then do you help them from that aspect from there with the modeling? You can show them, okay.
Yeah. Oh, you're talking about energy?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. It's an ongoing process. You know, we're very much into building capacities, clearly, because they have to be sustainable.
And talking about building capacities and mentioning the possible, you know, the interest for 60 other reactors, it could be small, could be big. Is the greatest need, for example, like in Africa?
The energy poverty there. Yes, of course. There's a real need. But it's also a number of smaller countries. But Africa's desperate for energy. And they need it for development.
Right.
And they're going to use whatever source they can. If you look at the largest growth in nuclear energy at the moment, you're looking at China, you're looking at India, enormous populations with enormous energy needs. What are they going to do? Burn fossil fuel? Yes, they're going to continue to burn fossil fuels. They're going to use biomass. They're going to use whatever possible. Renewable.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Great Talk Radio starts here.
But what we need to be taking it forward is making sure it's done as safe as possible. And that's why we come back to where we started, lessons learned, how to move forward.
And providing that information. And as you said, what was it coming up in September?
Hmm?
Is it the conference coming up in September?
Later this month.
Yeah, later this month.
Later this month, 2 weeks' mm-hmm. time in Vienna.
Mm. And that's a big one, obviously, in all of
meetings.
This.
And we expect all 151 member states have been invited, the Secretary General, UN, other different agencies, all coming together and looking at how we're going to move forward on this.
Wow. Jeff Shaw, interesting. You have an interesting job, my friend. Thanks so much for stopping by and spending some time with us here on America Tonight.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
How would you like to rev up your metabolism and energy while lifting your spirits? Now a new healthy tea is available that will do just that, and it's called Zoom Tea. Zoom Tea was developed for a former welterweight boxing champion to increase his energy and focus in the ring. Zoom Tea is an alternative healthy pick-me-up that can replace coffee, common tea, or soda. Zoom Tea also helps remove radiation from the body, promotes weight loss, and is high in antioxidants. For a limited time, get our introductory price for a one-month supply of this amazing tea for just $20, or a two-month supply for only $35, and we'll pay the shipping and handling. Go to our website now and start feeling the healthy and energizing benefits from drinking Zoom Tea. Go to ZoomTea.com. That's ZoomTea.com. Or call toll-free 877-341-4769. 877-341-4769 today.
Summer's getting into full swing, and so is the Happy Summer Sale here at OfTheField.com. If food became too expensive, scarce, or questionable to fill your needs, would you know what to do? Do you want an all-natural backup plan? Nature provides, but you have to know how to use it. We are offering site-wide savings even on our already discounted packages. It's been extended until Monday, June 13th, so head on over to OfTheField.com. If you really don't have access to the Internet, call 1-888-51-EAT-FREE. That's 1-888-513-2837, and they'll take care of you. Just use coupon code FREEFOODNOW, all one word, to save on your entire shopping cart. Do it now. We've been holding our prices for the last 3 years, and something's got to give. Catalog customers can take advantage by writing Free Food Now on top of your order form. Figure the shipping before taking 10% off on your merchandise total, then add it up and send it in for Free Food Know-How at OfTheField.com.
Will I have garlic breath after I take Ali-C?
We get that question all the time about the world's best garlic extract, Ali-C. And the answer is, Ali-C contains stabilized allicin, nature's antimicrobial agent, and the active ingredient in crushed garlic, but will not give you garlic breath. Scientifically proven in double-blind studies, using low doses of allicin greatly reduces the number, severity, and duration of common colds. Our powerful Ali-C contains 300 milligrams of stabilized allicin. Just one tablet of Ali-C is equivalent to 40 garlic cloves. It's effective against asthma, MRSA, bacterial, fungal, and viral infections, and helps lower high blood pressure and high cholesterol. Plus, it's a natural mosquito repellent. Boosts resistance to infection with nature's best garlic extract, Ali-C. For more information and to order Ali-C, call 877-888-7126 or go to garlichealthproducts.com. That's 877-888-7126 or garlichealthproducts.com. Fight back with Ali-C.
Welcome back to America Tonight, and here we are, and our final guest joining us, across from the UN, in fact, at the UN UNICEF facility. And I was jokingly saying to Cheryl Gregory Fay that it's a wonderful day in New York. It is a wonderful day to be here, but it's a very hot day. And Cheryl focuses on girls. She is the senior education advisor at UNICEF New York and heads the UN Girls Education Initiative Secretary, right? So I'll tell you what, this is near and dear to so many of our hearts, so many people who have daughters, so many people who see what's happening in the world with women. What is, first of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
What is the main thrust of what you're focusing on now? I know that's a broad question, but where's your energy going toward in these in issues that affect girls and women ultimately?
Well, as you know, girls and women are the key to the globe. Women hold up more than half of the sky and half of the efforts that go into developing the world. But specifically, we are involved with girls' education because we see girls' education, in fact, as being the silver bullet of absolutely tackling so many of the problems that are confronting the world today. As you know, in many countries, developing countries of the world, children are dying needlessly. There are issues where poverty and exploitation really have become such problems that they've created civil unrest and in some instances even warfare. But education is the key to resolving so much of this. And through research, we have learned that of all of the areas in which we can educate, you know, all of the groups that can benefit from education, we get the greatest return from return on investment from educating girls. And that's because educating girls helps to stimulate economies. The money goes back into the family. Educated girls grow up to have fewer children. Their children turn out to be healthier. Their children wind up getting immunized. They have better employment and other economic opportunities, and it winds up just being a win-win for everyone.
In talking about educating girls, so is the focus on countries who need the leg up, wherever it might be? I mean, some of the third world countries, for example, if you had I'll call it, for lack of a better way to describe it, a hit list of, okay, we're going to attack this area first, then let's go over here. Because it's not to say that there aren't pockets of poverty and many wealthy countries that you could certainly go after and help too. But where's your main focus, like your top three?
Well, certainly in terms of where we work primarily, where we concentrate our efforts, these are the countries that are that have a lot of poverty, countries that are least developed countries also that have high populations and not a sufficient number of girls in school. The world has seen a tremendous evolution in the past 10 years. 10 years ago, there were 100 million children out of school. And two-thirds of those children were girls. Last year, which is the year for which we have the most recent data, we had about 67 million children out of school, and about 54% of those were girls. So you see that we're making tremendous progress. But in reality, the countries that are better off, that are able to invest their own resources, that have better education systems in place, are making more rapid progress than the least developed countries and the countries that have huge populations that that require special attention. So the areas where we work the most are in sub-Saharan Africa and in South Asia, largely South and West Asia to a certain extent.
And we're talking about try to get them young, try to get, you know, elementary or just wherever you can step in.
Well, you know, first of all, one of the greatest indicators of whether or not a child's going to go to school and do well in school is the mother's educational level. So if you've got an educated mother, then already the child has a leg up. But beyond that, even children whose parents have not had the opportunity of an education, we try to get as many children as possible involved in early learning, in preschool activities, because preschool also gives children a tremendous advantage in going on to school. Beyond that, we try to target specific interventions that are related to issues like poverty. Children don't go to school, girls don't go to school sometimes because their parents can't afford school fees. And so you may have you know, specific interventions like scholarships for girls that would help to get children into school. You also have to deal with changing attitudes with regard to parents and communities. Frequently, boys are valued more than girls, mm-hmm. So if you can only afford to send one child to school, then make it the boy. Or you need the girl at home to help to care for the younger siblings or to do other domestic chores. Fetching water can be a huge chore that has to happen in the household, and the mother needs help, and frequently it's the girl that stays at home to help her mom with that. Other practices like marrying off girls early. Early marriage is a tremendous barrier to girls' education because, in fact, parents believe that by the time a girl hits puberty, that, in fact, she is of marriageable age in a lot of societies. And so, changing that attitude. Making certain that schools are closer to home because parents have greater concerns about the safety and security of their girls than they do of their boys because boys, it's just a cultural bias that people feel that boys are better able to defend themselves and to protect themselves. So all of these issues conspire in a certain way to keeping girls out of school. And what we do is to try to change the attitudes and also the policies in place in the countries to make certain that that girls do have the opportunity to go.
And so in doing that, fascinating, as you were saying, having to really change those attitudes, especially in doing that, I'm sure there's a delicate balance. Who do you send in? In other words, who's on the ground? Who's on the ground working in some of these areas, especially the two countries you mentioned?
Yes. Well, UNICEF has offices in over 170 countries worldwide, and so we have staff on the ground there that are working in health and in child protection and in education, who provide a technical resource, if you will, with our partners. Now, our primary partner in working on the ground is government. As much as UNICEF invests, as much as the world invests in foreign aid to education in these countries, the governments wind up investing so much more. The overwhelming majority of education budgets in developing countries comes from the government budgets themselves. However, sometimes the right choices aren't made of where resources need to be invested. Sometimes countries are involved in education systems that don't provide the best quality, and quality issues also conspire to keep children out of school. If a child goes to school and feels stigmatized or discriminated against for whatever reason, if the teacher's not being fair with certain categories of children because they happen to be girls or because of other factors, these are issues that that we're working with governments, with teachers associations, with parents associations, with nonprofit agencies to try to address so that all children will have the opportunities that they deserve to a quality education.
Yeah. We have a minute and a half or so left. What's been the most rewarding part of this for you? Are you seeing some progress?
Oh, absolutely. We are able to see girls that are the first in their generation ever to go to school. I remember the case of one girl in particular in Uganda who whose parents had never been to school, who was able to go to school through a special scholarship program. She went into elementary school. She managed to do quite well. She went into secondary school. She continued to do quite well. She managed to win a place at the university and got a full scholarship, graduated from university, and just the pride that she showed, the hope, the enthusiasm, what she can do to contribute to her nation,
right,
the pride of her family and her community in her accomplishments. That's what it's all about.
And there you go. Cheryl, thanks so much for stopping by. We appreciate it. Speak for many people probably listening to the show. We appreciate the hard work that you're doing and keep making a difference.
Thank you so much.